Hello, people. Welcome to the Carnival of Film Reviews that is the One Liner Podcast. My name's Scott Boris, and joining me today is Drew Tavendale. Is Drew Tavendale?
Hello.
I don't know why I decided to do that. It was weird. Still no Craig. He's still on manoeuvres in Europe, so we are, again, a man down, but thankfully we have a slightly more manageable list of films to get through today.
Which is good, given Scott's apparently had a stroke. Or become a zombie, one of the two.
And with that seamless link in mind, let's go on to talk about the first film, Paranorman. Drew, give us a lowdown on that.
Okie dokie. In the New England town of Blythe Hollow lives 11-year-old Norman. And this Norman, he likes zombie movies. He gets bullied at school. His parents don't understand him, nor he they. Doesn't get on with his sister. So there's nothing out of the ordinary there so far. But young Norman is able to see and converse with ghosts, which is a bit inconvenient for an 11-year-old who's already got problems making friends, particularly when he's the only person around who can do so. This talent certainly doesn't help him evade the notice of bullies. Things certainly don't improve when he starts to experience visions of the trial and death sentence of a witch, the 300th anniversary of whose death the town is about to celebrate, and he prophesies zombie apocalypse, which is my favourite flavour of apocalypse. So when the dead do indeed rise from their graves, it's up to Norman and an unlikely group of helpers to sort things out. You know, it's damned unhygienic having all those reanimated corpses traipsing about, not to mention the problems of, you know, mass hysteria, mobs, and people being eaten alive. Paranorman comes to us from Laika, the same studio that produced Coraline, and while it doesn't quite reach those heights, it's a solidly entertaining film. It looks absolutely lovely. The stop-motion animation is excellent, as you'd expect from the studio that produced Coraline. And like Coraline, it's full of things to frighten kids, which is great. I've said it before and I'll say it again, there's still not enough of that. There are too many movies aimed at kids that play it too safe. Probably because adults think they know what kids want or shouldn't watch, and they're generally wrong. Now, Paranorman isn't as polished as Coraline, and the story unfortunately isn't quite as strong. One other notable fact is that the central character in Paranorman is a little featureless, perhaps bland is the word compared to the supporting players, but it's a really good family movie. There's plenty of fun and frights for the kids, and plenty of jokes and classic zombie movie references for the adults. It's fun, so watch it.
Yeah, there's a lot to like in Paranorman. I'm sure I wouldn't want to live in a small town in America if films have anything to go by. There just seems to be far too high an instance of, you know, paranormal activities and zombies. And I just live in the city, okay? You might get mugged now and again, but you're probably going to keep your head for the most part. The main thing that I took away from Paranorman compared to Coraline is that I think it is just about as well written. I think the story's almost as good. The characters are almost as good. What it doesn't have is the same kind of fairly unique voice that Neil Gaiman brought to Coraline. So it feels a bit more, as you say, a little bit more generic, a little bit more... I don't like using these terms because it's a little bit too prejudicial, I suppose. It's a little bit more conventional than Coraline was in the way it handles a lot of things.
Conventional or broad might be yeah. The word.
But despite that, it does work very well. It's often pretty funny. The character design's pretty good. It's a cut above most films, and it has better character progression than pretty much any other, at least nominally, kiddie-aimed film this year. For once, we don't have to exclude Pixar from that kind of statement. I think it is actually perhaps, I would say it is the best kids' movie that I've seen so far this year. I liked it more than Brave.
Yeah, I liked it more than Brave as well. The story's stronger in this. I mean, mm-hmm. I still think it's weak compared to Coraline, but the story's mm-hmm. stronger in this. It seems to have more idea of where it's going.
Yeah, it's nice to see a film that has a proper ending to it, that is not some ridiculous chase set piece or anything. The ending of this film is based purely on reason and talking someone down from their states of distress, which is quite rare for any kind of film, let alone a child's film.
Yes, absolutely.
At least normally. And I find a lot to appreciate in that. Between that and some really good vocal performances, more from perhaps from the adult cast than the kids, although there's nothing particularly wrong with any of the kids' performances.
A curiously hard to recognise Casey Affleck, which threw me. It's a fun character.
Indeed. Yeah, no, I thought there was an awful lot to like in Paranorman and very little to dislike. I would heartily recommend it to anyone. High recommendation to it. It's one of the best films I've seen this year.
So I don't think I liked it quite to the level you did, but very much enjoyed it. You mentioned Pixar, Scott. This is actually the second year in a row now that the Pixar film hasn't been the animated film of the year. Last year is the more notable one, I guess, when both Pixar and Studio Ghibli films were out, and neither of them were the best animated film we saw that year.
Yeah, shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, with the rather surprising but excellent Rango. This would apparently be this year's Rango. So, from a film about zombies known to fill people with dread, to a film where dread fills people with bullets. Scott? I can do worse.
Oh, and we will try before the night's out, yeah. Dread, based, of course, on Judge Dredd from the 2000 AD magazine and his own spin-off magazine. I suppose we should perhaps back up a little bit before we get into this, because in this line of work, we have seen a hell of a lot of comic book adaptations from the usual Marvel and DC suspects. I've wound up reading quite a lot about comic book characters just to get some kind of context into what I'm going into, although I've never actually read any of these comic books that these films are based on. I've never read a single episode of Spider-Man or X-Men or anything, apart possibly from maybe flicking through a couple in a library now and again, but I've certainly never purchased any comics with my own money, apart from 2000 AD and Judge Dredd magazine. Largely for Judge Dredd. So I was looking forward to this. I'm hardly the world's biggest Judge Dredd fan, after all. I kind of was doing some mental arithmetic the other day, and I've not actually bought an issue of Judge Dredd in about 13 years or so. But at the same time, I'm far more interested in Judge Dredd than I am any other comic book character that is out there. So I had allowed myself the luxury of looking forward to this a little bit, which maybe certainly had the potential to backfire given the Sylvester Stallone outing, which even then I can't actually bring myself to hate quite as much as perhaps I should.
Ah, please allow me to do that on your behalf.
I thought you hadn't seen that, or didn't want to see it, or I just blocked it off as a traumatic memory.
I've mostly blocked it off, but unfortunately the most traumatic bit is the one that I can clearly remember, and that's Rob Schneider.
I
shall hate that passionately on your behalf.
Yeah. Yes, thankfully this is a different beast entirely. If you're not familiar with Britain's premier post-apocalyptic fascist police state-based comic, Judge Dredd, or Dredd in this case.
Seriously, that's not the marketing tagline, is it?
No.
I've missed a trick there.
But better than just simply it's in 3D, seems to, which is more or less the marketing that they've done so far and hasn't worked out too well for them. But anyway, Dredd takes place in Megacity 1, a walled-off, ruined urban sprawl in the east coast of what used to be America, before the nukes dropped and turned much of America into an irradiated wasteland. Citizens of the city are crammed together in mega tower blocks, each of these blocks holding tens of thousands of people. The city's beleaguered with crime, and the only forces fighting the gangs and thugs is the judges, a highly trained, lethal police force empowered to uphold the law and dispense justice as they see fit, commonly at the end of a gun barrel. Of this group of highly trained, determined judges, Judge Dredd is the most highly trained, determined, capable, and inflexible of them all. He is called upon at the start of this film to give a field assessment to a judge cadet, Anderson, who's marginally failing her courses, but she's been given a little bit more slack than usual on account of being the most powerful psychic that the Justice Department has ever encountered. Believing that she could be a great asset if Cassandra Anderson shapes up, she's given to Judge Dredd to go out and patrol for one day and see if she makes the grade. Unfortunately, the one call that she chooses to respond to is to Peachtree's tower block, which is controlled by a vicious warlord, Mama, who runs a gang who has taken over all of the 200-level structure by violently deposing the other groups vying for control before her arrival, and she is also on the verge of trying to take over the city by her wonderful new drug called Slow-Mo. Slow-Mo is a drug which makes the user feel time is slowed to 1% of its normal rate.
Slow-Mo is cake.
Yes, for those who remember the old Brass Eye thing, it's basically cake. But this has the potential to take over the whole city, but it's apparently something of a desirable drug, and it's desirable for us because it gives us a really lovely visual effect when people are actually on this stuff. So the rest of the film is essentially Dredd and Anderson having to escape from an isolated tower block. Once Mama discovers that the judges are there, she locks the place off and essentially sicks the entire building on Judge Dredd and Anderson trying to get him to take care of the problem by killing the problem. And Dredd doesn't take kindly to that kind of threat. The essential plot can basically be summed up in the same way as the action film from a few months back, The Raid, the excellent Indonesian chop socky flick. A couple of policemen have to take on an entire tower full of bad guys and get to the top to take on the evil controller at the top. That rough thematic similarity aside, there's not really a hell of a lot of other crossover with The Raid. This is far more interested in gunplay, and aided in part by Judge Dredd's excellent Lawgiver gun, which is a variety of interesting ammunition types which make for some really great action scenes, and that's at the heart of what makes Judge Dredd such a fun film.
And one particular type of ammunition, apparently just designed for shits and giggles.
Yeah. Not practical, but fun. And you've got to have a little fun in your day job, I think. It's actually not one of the most violent action films that we've seen, but it is one of the few 18 or restricted rated action films. I don't know if maybe I'm just getting a bit more desensitised in these days, but certainly in terms of, you know, metric tonnage, there's probably less people being killed in this than there was in, say, The Expendables 2. However, I suppose it does take a bit more delight in showing you the results of violence in this film. When there's a lot of these action scenes that are taken through, sort of seen through the eyes of someone in slow-mo, under the influence of the slow-mo drug, which gives a great excuse to have this slow-motion carnage unfolding of what happens when you introduce high-caliber weaponry to a human body. It's not a pretty sight for most people, yet it somehow the visual stylings of this does actually make it look quite appealing.
It's almost poetic, which makes me think there's something very wrong with me. But
yeah,
there's just seeing people torn apart by a ridiculous minigun in slow motion. It's a poem in blood and gore.
So a veritable bullets of ballet, or ballet with bullets, or whatever the John Wooism was. There is a really appealing visual style to this that is not present in any other film, specifically comic book film, that I've seen the last few decades. It has a very clear visual style, which is not something that you can say about a hell of a lot of films, which is mainly just, you know, whatever the CG department cacked out for that particular movie. This does actually look like it's had some real thought going into the styling of the piece. Thankfully, it's not all just style. It does actually have a lot of substance to it as well, at least in the fact that everything that it does, it manages to do really well and really quite fun. All the action scenes are really well handled. There's touches of character. Dredd's a tough character, I think, to put on films, because he is kind of one-dimensional. If you read the comics over the course of years, it's not that his character doesn't develop. It's just that it happens over the course of 30 years rather than 30 minutes. He's largely implacable, a big mound that people can throw themselves against. In a lot of the comic books, Judge Dredd's really not the main character in the film. Mega City 1 is, and the bizarre denizens that are in there. This doesn't have that. It has to instead kind of focus on introducing Judge Dredd to you without actually going through the rigmarole of giving you any kind of origin story. You're pretty much introduced to him in situ, and you can learn pretty much everything that you need to know about Judge Dredd pretty quickly, and it does so in that really effective introduction scene.
It's like Dredd, badass, done.
Yeah, Anderson gets to, as she does in the comics, get a bit more licensed to be a bit more humanised, and it's really her that has to take up the reins of the emotional heart of the film. But even then, it's not really a film that is based on anyone's, you know, journey to acceptance of any particular fate or anything like that. And although Olivia Thirlby does quite well in portraying this, that really the revelation in the film is Carol Urban, whose Judge Dredd is obviously much, much better than Sylvester Stallone's. Not that that's saying much, but it's a really effective performance from him, especially given that, as you have from Judge Dredd, you can't take your helmet off, because otherwise you're not Judge Dredd. So basically, it's really acting through the medium of his chin.
Exactly. It works quite well. It's the most impressive performance from a chin I've ever seen. Ever. Because he doesn't do all the mistakes that were made in the 1995 film. You know, he doesn't wisecrack, he doesn't take his helmet off, he doesn't have a sympathetic side. It's like, no, he's brittle but efficient and completely taciturn. So you've basically got Carl Urban spending the whole film just going, grunting and then showing his chin. And it's remarkably really rather compelling.
Yeah, I mean, he's not humorless or characterless or anything. He's just very much a deadpan snarker, and that works really well in especially in this kind of landscape where everyone's cracking wise every 5 minutes. So if you get a hold of Craig Eastman's blog on Tumblr, then you can see his rant on the Avengers, which he didn't like very much for some reason, and he's not quite so enamoured with the kind of snappy dialogue or purported snappy dialogue that people like Joss Whedon will have, where everything's all very clipped and trying to be reactive to events with little snappy one-liners here, there and everywhere. Dredd wouldn't really go in for that anyway. He's more of a and then he'll shoot you, which is works far better in this film than it has any other right to.
That's been a little unfair, Scotty. It does sometimes mix up a wee bit. He will sometimes shoot you, then go, meh.
That's true. He's a complicated cat. No, really liked it. There is so much to like in this film, and I'm so depressed that it has not particularly been taken to heart's going by the box office results in the UK and America. It's not doing disastrously, but it's certainly not looking like it's, you know, going to take back all of its money in the first week or so. But for a film that is this good and also looks so terrific...
Yeah, it's really cheap.
Yeah, 50 million, apparently, is the rough estimate of the budgets.
It looks so much more.
Looks better than any action film I've seen almost this year, certainly with the comic books, other than probably the Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah.
Which has the benefits of scale, which you don't get in here because it's obviously fairly claustrophobic, and they've really done the absolute perfect story to meet their budget and still kind of have all the elements of Judge Dredd that you'd want in there. I think this works tremendously well, and I really enjoyed it.
It looks so much more expensive than it is, and it also proves, as the complete lie we always knew it was, that 3D films cost so much more to make.
Yeah, crazy.
Because, again, I'd probably still rather not see it in 3D because I don't like it as much, but of all the films that were 3D, it's the one that's actually used it for anything useful.
Yeah.
When it's making use of the showing the effects of slow-mo, it's when the 3D really comes into its own. And it's this cheap compared to other films.
The two films that I've seen, I quite like the 3D in this, and I quite like the 3D in Coraline, just to tie in with this, what we were talking about earlier. But it even though it's not that it's necessary, I just find that when it's done nicely, it adds kind of some texture to things that you don't normally get. But when it's been used to try and add spectacle to it, it fails because it just doesn't really work all that well as a kind of attention-grabbing gizmo anymore. You can't just have people throwing things at the screen anymore and expect to be impressed by it. But when it's done a little bit more subtly, as it's done with the most part of this, that works quite well.
So, Scott, you're saying you can't just throw things at the screen, but the new Resident Evil film trailer seems to suggest that that's what they'll be doing for the entire film, and you're suggesting that that might be bad?
No, I'm confident that Resident Evil will responsibly handle all aspects of filmmaking as it always does.
Didn't like throwing things at the screen just so they flew out in 3D become passé in about 1954?
Yes. But between that and the new penchant for let's fit cinemas with seats that wobble and shake when you're watching a film, there's no limit to gimmickry. I'm afraid of what they're going to come up with next, to be honest with you. I expect it will actually be some kind of action film where people actually start punching you as you're watching it just to add some impact to the piece. Not looking forward to that. But Dredd, I thought, was... if not the best pure action film this year, because much as like Dark Knight Rises, it's only an action film by default in a couple of places. It's almost more a character piece than it is
absolutely
action.
Absolutely a character piece, yeah.
I would have to toss a coin between it and The Raid, actually, as best action film I've seen so far this year. So either way, whichever one I decide to give it the edge to, it's definitely worth watching this.
I would have to more or less agree with all of that. Having not seen The Raid yet, this would probably make this, by default, the best action film I've seen this year. It's a hoot is what it is. It's just, it gets everything right that the 1995 Danny Cannon film got wrong. It's fun. And although the music's wrong, clearly given that the whole film's based on the drug Cake, the soundtrack should have been provided by DJ Bob Hoskins going mental in a dustbin. It's surprising but quite pleasing to find that the main song played throughout at several points was the Snuffbox theme tune.
Yeah. puzzling addition to any film soundtrack.
That was really, really odd, but quite pleasing for anybody like us who recognises it.
From Judge Dredd and his excellent machine gun mounted lawgiver bike to a really shitty bike, as Joseph Gordon-Levitt gets on a fixie and drums about delivering couriers and Premium Rush. Drew, what's that all about?
So Premium Rush then, or hipster arsehole on a bike.
Yes.
Not that it's being a hipster that makes an arsehole, although obviously it does. Wiley, named after the unfortunate Looney Tunes coyote, is a man... Are you smoking a doobie?
No, I just don't like this film.
So Wiley is a, as said, named after the Looney Tunes coyote, is a Manhattan bike messenger who eschews such extravagances as gears, brakes, traffic laws, and courtesy. He likes to ride, and in his quest to deliver packages as quickly as possible, he doesn't care who he cuts up or causes to swerve or brake suddenly, ergo, arsehole. Beginning with Wiley flying through the air and landing heavily on the ground after a collision, Fumi and Rush then jumps back several hours to tell the tale of how one particularly dangerous delivery job brought him to this point. It's interspersed with a few scenes explaining how Wiley is the most awesomest bike courier in the world! As each new portion of backstory is shown, the connections appear and we see how each player in the tale got to be where they are when we met them earlier, regardless of how stupid it is. But despite these links being blindingly obvious when these story portions are shown, director David Cope keeps with them up to and even past the part of the story we've already seen. No, just in case we're too dumb to work out which part of the film they fit into. And the idea here is that Wiley's been given a really dangerous package to deliver by a certain time, and a big bad man called Bobby's after him because he wants it too. And the reason for this package, the context of this package, may as well have had MacGuffin written on it, and probably should have done, because the reason given in the film is fucktarded, frankly. You know, the fact that Wiley is so named is no coincidence. You know, Premier Rush is in many ways a live-action cartoon, although video game probably seems more appropriate. There are constant bits in the film where we see like a sat-nav route of where Wiley's got to go from where, and then his options intersections are overlaid as graphics on the screen, but they're so constantly reused that you feel like you're stuck in a tutorial for an Xbox Live Arcade game.
Hey everybody, welcome to Crazy Fixie!
That's about the size of it, yeah. It's somewhere between Crazy Taxi and Paperboy. I mean, it's not all bad. The fact that Wiley is even vaguely tolerable is testament to Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And Michael Shannon puts in decent, perhaps giving him too much praise, but not awful turn as the ridiculous villain of the piece, Bobby. And there are also some good chase sequences on bikes, which are actually rather entertaining, but they do get very, very samey very quickly. You know, if you can get your head into the mindset that this is like a live-action cartoon and disengage your critical faculties, then you might enjoy this as a mindless chase movie. But as I can't, and instead spent a large portion of this film hoping to see the hero wiped out by an 18-wheeler, I certainly couldn't recommend it. In contrast to me, Scott, I believe you loved this, didn't you?
That would be an accurate statement. That would not be correct, no.
I've got that entirely wrong.
That's almost the complete inverse of what I would say. To be honest, I didn't think I was going to like this film. It looked like a B-movie, a schedule filler, more than anything else. But I do like Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and I do like Michael Shannon. I've not seen him in an awful lot since Festival a few years back.
The missing person, I think.
Yeah, the kind of sort of strange, noirish kind of thing.
Yeah. The last couple of years, he's had a really good role in Boardwalk Empire, which he plays extremely well.
Right.
So he's keeping up the standard.
To my regret, still haven't seen, but I liked enough people in front of the camera to at least give it a go. And for maybe half an hour, this whole kind of gimmick of bike chases is interesting. It piqued my curiosity. At least you don't get an awful lot of bike chases in cinema, so it's interesting to see. The camera work for that kind of stuff's quite nice. There's some decent stunts. But after about 20 minutes, half an hour, I'd pretty much seen everything that it had to offer, and from that point you might as well have just looped it, because it felt like I was watching the same bit over and over again. Barely distinguishable chase sequences for about another hour after that, which was really getting on my nut. I would have cut it a little bit more slack if I was able to invest in Wiley's struggles, but unfortunately if he were a bag he would be composed entirely of douche. It's all very deliberate. I mean, you're introduced to it at the start as basically him narrating, "I'm a total tool," and then expecting you to somehow care about them. And it's not Levitt's fault, as if anything he's overplaying it somehow. He's accurately portraying the character written for him, but he's just written as a really irritating arsehole. If anything, he's probably too likeable in and of himself for the complete arsehole that he's playing. Plots just chase this MacGuffin around New York with barely distinguishable action scenes and characters that I don't care about one way or the other.
This thing you said about half an hour after that scene, very samey, and that's almost exactly how I was feeling. Like, you know, it's a 30-minute movie, a long short, if you will.
Yeah,
this might work.
Yeah,
it might be quite fun. It seemed to just add too much, so we'll have another bike chase here. But it's just the same as the last one. Yes, but I want the bike chase here, and we'll have the villain doing something really, really stupid for some reason. It's just something completely over the top for the situation he's in.
Yeah.
The reason for the package is just so stupid, and the person whose package it is just quite frankly so utterly nothing.
Yeah.
terrible actress playing a completely underwritten role. So there's no reason to care for that. It's clearly been added in to give you some emotional reason to care. And it doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's really kind of artless. It's just, if they just made it, a MacGuffin's like, there's a package and this guy wants to get it.
Yeah.
That's compelling. You don't know. He's like, well, maybe you want to know. But when they actually explain it, it's like, oh, right, okay. That was dumb.
I think it shows off a strange weakness, because the only reason that the character who's this package is being delivered exists is because you need someone slightly sympathetic to have this go to, and the three sort of main couriers in it aren't. And couldn't you have just made one of those not a total prick and used that as what we'll give it as one of their packages instead? Or, you know, it's a character that's essentially a band-aid to fix a gaping character hole.
Oh, are you saying the three main characters aren't well written? It's got the three main characters who are, I believe, Wanker, Prima Donna and Token Woman.
No, I didn't like this much. I wouldn't recommend that. I'm making it sound a lot worse than it is, but I just, at the end of the day, I just found it kind of boring, which meant that I was sitting there picking, well, more flaws than I normally would with something like this. If I had managed to kind of have interesting chases for the 90 minutes, then I wouldn't have had so much to complain about on it. Yeah, I would have let a lot more things slide. The fact that after 30 minutes it really has nothing new to offer gives an absolute death knell for it.
Yep.
It is by no means the worst film you're ever going to see or see this year, but the fact that it's one of the most boring films is a problem for something that promises to be a high-octane cycle, right?
So yes, I wouldn't rush out to see this or see it at any point. So, from a bike courier who can care less for the law, Scott, to law less. Told you they could get worse. We do work at this, you know.
Not very hard, but we do work at it.
We do put effort into making them as cringeworthy as possible.
Lawless drops us into Prohibition-era Virginia, featuring the Bonnerat brothers, who are busy bootlegging up some moonshine for selling on Chicago's black market. Elder brothers Howard, played by Jason Clarke, and Forrest, played by Tom Hardy, take care of business for the most part, leaving the youngest brother, Jack, played by Shia LaBeouf, minding the gas station / diner that I presume is the legitimate business front for their life of crime, and also because Jack's a complete pansy. Things pick up, at least in theory, when the law arrives with a view to shut down the moonshine trade. Well, actually with a view to taking a hefty cut of the profits from the moonshine trade, being as these cops are coming from Chicago, the only police force more corrupt than Gotham City. Chief Law Dude, and your nominated bad guy of this piece, is Guy Pearce's Charlie Rakes, who I assume was promoted to the ranks due to his astonishing weirdness. Thus runs the conflict with the other bootleggers in the area eventually, buckling and giving in to this extortion racket, leaving with the Bandarant as the only holdout. Rakes's goons send a message to the Bandarant, who respond in kind, sparking a circle of violence that escalates until you've wind up with pitched shootouts between lines of cops and moonshiners and such like. It perhaps has the conflict element shown up, but what Lawless can't do is translate this into any kind of drama whatsoever. There's no reason to emphasise with any of the moonshine and anti-heroes, with Howard largely being a one-dimensional violent drunk, Jack a whiny braggart, and Forrest a kind of laconic wannabe patriarch with nary a likeable character trait to rub between them, apart perhaps from family loyalty. Jack and Howard get some largely disposable love interests to attempt to humanise them, in the shape of Mia Wasikowska and Jessica Chastain, but in the end, both of these seem largely to leverage into damsel in distress type plot devices to spur some other excuse for conflicted parties to inflict violence upon each other. Now, I'm not necessarily against inflicting violence. It might be distasteful, but it carries the potential to be interesting, but even here, Lawless just can't quite do it. While it does show the horrible consequences of getting caught in this kind of turf war, from showing the results of, say, cutting someone's throat in a rather terrifying way, which is something that is actually missing from most contemporary movies, it manages to show these kind of horrible after effects without actually glamorising it, which a lot of films can do, and these, especially these kind of cops versus robbers kind of things. But it does undercut itself by making the Bondurants basically impossible to kill unless you chop their heads off and their limbs and bury them in different states. The other side of the conflict isn't any better in terms of the characterisation stakes. Charlie Rakes is unlikable, but he's unlikable in ways that make him really annoying rather than someone you'd want to see get their comeuppance.
He's basically a cartoon villain.
Well, he's even worse than that, because the Bond runts aren't particularly rounded characters, but at least they're sort of very simply written and make some kind of internal sense. But Rakes is just this weird, puzzling mix of mutually exclusive character flaws.
Yeah,
and really weak motivation. It's just a total pastiche of things that don't make any sense at all. Not an even remotely believable character.
Yeah, it's the lack of motivation is the big problem, basically. They've got this guy who's really, really weird, and doesn't like human contact at all, which they then seem to forget later on. You know, I'll accept that, but it's the fact that he seems to have come down there to be a prick for the sake of being a prick.
Yeah.
It's basically what it comes down to. I don't see the point of the character. He's got no reason to act like he does.
Yeah.
He's not for wrong to anything. He just decides that these people have offended him by existing. I don't know.
Yeah. If he's just trying to get money out of them, he's doing everything in the wrong way. And then at some point, it just kind of flips to the point, I just want to stomp them out. And he does that in the wrong way as well. So
yeah.
I don't understand it. It's very poorly explained, if it's explained at all. I don't think it really
has any
particular clear idea of what's going on. That's strange, I thought, given that this comes from the director-writer team-up that brought us Proposition, which was a very nice little, well-executed tale of outlaws going about their business, which worked a hell of a lot better than Lawless does. I suppose it says a lot that IMDb is currently pointing, and it's people who liked this also liked Gizmo, is currently pointing people to Animal Kingdom, because that was also a boring, drawn-out slice of violent nothing. I mean, I don't necessarily think that all films need to have a point, as it were. You know, things like Judge Dredd doesn't really have a point, or a message, or even a surfeit originality or any sort of genre redefining whatevers. I just want them at the end of the day to be enjoyable. And Lawless really, really isn't. There's nothing there. There's no one to take any kind of interest in at all.
That's the big problem. You might let some of the other stuff slide if you had any good reason to care for any of the characters, but you don't.
Yeah.
And it's a strange thing too. You mentioned family values. How come it's only ever criminals that are shown in films having family values?
Yeah.
It's kind of weird, because they're probably the people least likely to have them.
Yeah, it's all very crazy. Violent psychopath, but he loved his mother. And again, like the Three Man Rush, it's not all negative. It's by far, far from the worst film you're going to see. I don't like any of the characters, but at least for the most part, the acting's reasonable. They're doing the best with what they have. The cinematography and all the other sort of mechanical aspects of the stuff's never less than competent. It's just so unlikable and underwritten in terms of the characterisation and the plot. And it does have this kind of aura of reaching and trying to grasp some kind of greater meta point about the nature of conflict or something like that, but it never can find it and never takes any kind of hold of that, and it's just sort of left dangling. There just doesn't seem to be any particular good rationale for why this film should exist. I can't market this to anyone. If someone said, you know, who would you recommend watch this film? It was like someone who likes being a bit bored in cinemas. There really isn't anything that I can latch on to come out with as any kind of positive to it. It's just a bunch of stuff that happens, and it's not very interesting while it does it.
It's not quite to the level of something like, say, Public Enemies, where John Dillinger really was a real fiend, but it's not those films that seem to be suggesting that there's something noble about the criminal in this and that they're the hero, as opposed to, you know, just an evil murdering bastard.
Yeah.
It's not as bad as Public Enemies was, with Michael Mann trying to suggest that John Dillinger's some sort of hero because, I know, people are idiots, I guess. The Bondi Run brothers seem to spend less time, you know, just randomly killing their competitors and creating mayhem. But as he says, well, there's not any particular reason to recommend it. There's no compelling story. I mean, it's not bad in any conventional sense, it just seems rather pointless.
It is not the violence that sets men apart, it's the distance they are prepared to go.
Your brain's beginning to turn into Goldfinger.
I've always thought it was very similar. I don't know why, it just reminds me a bit of Goldfinger, or possibly even Goldmember. So, from one thing that I can't think of anything that would have in common with another thing. So, The Untouchables. It's kind of a bit like the Chicago Prohibition era film, if you mangled
the title.
See,
you've done there is added an S onto that. You searched it on IMDb, didn't you?
Untouchables. So, Untouchables, L and S, true.
Yes, or Untouchable, as it may actually be, if you get confused and look up on IMDb. Let's get the bad stuff out of the way first, particularly the ludicrous stereotyping. Quadriplegic Philippe is rich, white, likes classical music, and is rather uptight. His carer, former convict Driss, is a black immigrant who lives in a council estate, likes disco and can dance. There's also the plot, based on a true story as it may be, and we all know just how much that means. It's entirely predictable, and the story of the black servant helping the white employer enjoy their life more is a pretty old one. Just ask Morgan Freeman. Fortunately, though, there's also plenty good here. I mean, this film immediately got on my good side by having a quadriplegic fake a seizure to get his friend out of trouble with the police and for a bet within the opening minutes. And that's deliciously inappropriate. I mean, that set me up nicely for the film. There's great chemistry here, too, between Francois Cluzet as Philippe and Omosai as Driss, who he's employed as his carer after being rather impressed by him in an interview that he didn't actually try in. And they're both tremendously enjoyable to watch. The chemistry helps, too, with seeing the story as, rather than like the poor black guy helping the white older guy, rich guy, it's more a story of a tale of friendship, really, of two people helping each other make more of their lives. But most importantly, though, it's bloody funny.
Yeah.
Now, I'm a cynical sort of fellow, and this sort of story, particularly with the racial stereotyping, is often likely to chafe with me. But I just spent pretty much the entire runtime with a huge smile on my face. At least when I wasn't laughing, in which case the smile was considerably larger. I don't think there's a lot more to add to that. The chemistry's great, it's incredibly entertaining, and it's thoroughly recommended by me.
Yep, boringly, have to agree. A couple of very likeable central performances. That really sets the whole film up. Excellent casting. They just work so well together. Such great chemistry.
That's some of the best chemistry I've seen on screen between two leads in quite a while, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's actually at its weakest when it starts talking about either of the people's sort of backgrounds, and it's far better when they're just concentrating on, you know, talking to each other and just getting on with their life. It's good to see that you can actually have some kind of comedy that involves disabled people, and at some point even has disabled people kind of being the kind of willing butts of the joke without it being exploitative
absolutely.
Obviously so much controversy, especially these days, about the kind of Frankie Boyle-isms that he can come up with, where he feels very much like it's him punching down and picking on the weak and helpless, where this is a far better example of how you can actually involve disabled people and disabled themes in comedy without it being exploitative or insulting like that. It works so well. Mm-hmm. There's lots of really cool little touches in the film, like trying to get the wheelchair souped up. Things like that. It's the guy may be disabled, but he's certainly not taking letting himself go. Almost nothing I didn't like in this, apart perhaps from when it sort of stumbles to an ending where he's eventually let go from his service, which didn't really seem to make any particular sense as to why he was let go and was kind of somewhat undone within very short order.
Yeah, there's no compelling reason for that, because, you know, they sort of insert family drama bomb here.
Yeah.
But there was no reason he couldn't have done that when he wasn't working.
It just seemed to need some kind of way to end, and that's how they chose to have it stop rather than really end. As I believe these guys have remained friends until present day. I believe so.
Yeah, it's no suggestion that it's in the distant past or anything. It's still ongoing.
Perhaps it was more of an expedient way of having the film not go on for another 30 years. But I probably wouldn't have minded too much if it went on for another 30 years.
It's absolutely joyous, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just two really likeable people having fun for the most part, and that works far better than, well, perhaps there has any like to. It's not by no means the most tightly plotted or such like. There's no real plot to it other than there are two people and they talk to each other.
Yeah.
And somehow that works tremendously well. It shows you don't need to have any real complicated plot devices when you just have people that are so compelling and charismatic to watch. So yes, definitely worth looking at.
That brings us to the end of this Podmax. We're doing pretty reasonably well, particularly by our standards, with this new regular schedule, so we would imagine we'll be back with you in about a fortnight.
Yes, so we're on course to screw it up colossally and come back in about 3 months. So.
Yes, but the fact we managed it more than 1 week in a row, and it's now several, more or less, bodes well, so we'll hopefully speak to you very soon. If you want to contact us, you can email us at podcast@theoneliner.com or follow us on Twitter @theoneliner. So until then, though, that's all from us. I have been Drew Tavendale, and Scott Morris was, I believe, Scott Morris, unless he's a very, very good liar.
Goodbye, farewell, Daddy Bubbles.
That'll do as an outro, won't it?
Oh, bad Bobby.
Bobby. Big bad Bobby.
Bobby.
Bobby. Bobby.
Bobby. Bobby.